Before you start listening to this podcast, we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, which will give you full access to everything on our website, and we'll also throw in a free £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Today, the EU set out its stall ahead of the negotiations with the UK for Brexit, and it published its first mandate for the negotiations, which all 27 remaining members of the EU have agreed to. Now, James, you're writing in the magazine this week about the potential clash between Britain and the EU ahead of these negotiations. What was in this draft mandate, and was it much of a surprise?
So we've seen the EU mandate published today. The UK one will be published on Thursday. When you look, it is quite clear that on the first two issues that the EU say must be addressed, the level playing field and governance, the two sides are far apart. The UK argument is, all we want from you is a simple free trade agreement. So what we should be looking at is non-regression, essentially, that neither side are going to try and use regulation to undercut the other. So you won't seek a trade advantage by slashing your labour or environmental standards. That's the normal formulation you get in a free trade agreement. The EU argument is, no. The UK is so close to the EU, it's 26 miles from its coastline, and the UK and EU economies are so interlinked that we need something more than that. And what the UK want is high standards with the EU standard acting as the reference point. Now, this isn't full-on dynamic alignment, saying that, you know, the UK must just put into its own law whatever the EU decides to do. But it is clearly saying that if the EU were, for example, to tighten up environmental legislation in response to climate change, that it would then expect the UK to follow suit. Now, I think this is going to be the cause of a big row in the first meetings next week, because the UK will say, no, we wouldn't expect you to abide by our standards. So what is going on here? All we want is the kind of deal that you signed with Canada, Japan and South Korea, and that doesn't include any of this stuff. And I think the two sides will talk past each other, probably in increasingly angry tones, in the first few weeks. I mean, ultimately, if both sides are prepared to look for it, you can see a compromise, which is the UK says it will maintain its own high standards. The EU says that it will reserve the right to take action if it doesn't think that the UK is doing this. But I mean, that will cause an initial row. And if you look, there is very little trust at the moment on either side. The Irish are already accusing the UK of trying to kind of renege on its commitments in the Irish protocol. The UK side are saying, well, you said that this could all be done by December 2020. You're now saying that that is impossible. And so you see a lot of tension. And I think before we see a deal, we will see a row. I mean, I was very struck the other day by not only a number 10 saying, as I said on Coffee House at the weekend, you know, that they expect the talks will blow up shortly. You know, one influential member state told me recently that their central planning assumption now is that there is no deal concluded by the end of this year.
And Katie, later in the week, we are expecting the UK version of this mandate to be released. I think the XS Committee in Cabinet, that's the two letters rather than too much, approved their mandate today. Are you expecting them, do you think, to take this sort of hard line and meet the EU on these big sort of crunch issues like level playing field regulations?
Well, we know the UK doesn't want to sign up to these things. And I think the clearest indication is still the David Frost speech, which is available on Coffee House for those who would like to read the full version. But I think moving on from that, are things going to change? I think the core theme of that speech, and it was a similar theme of Boris Johnson's first speech of his majority of 80, also available on Coffee House, was ultimately this sense that sovereignty comes above worries about the economy. Now, there's also the backup that the government would say, you can focus on certain industries and how they might be negatively affected by certain Brexit arrangements. If you look at, you know, these supply chains, that's often mentioned in terms of manufacturing industries, but there's lots of parts of the economy that could really prosper under a looser arrangement with the EU. But even putting that to one side, the key message that David Frost was making was, don't think that the UK government hasn't worked out the catches that come with various agreements, such as the Australian-style model, which is also known as trading largely on WTO. They are aware of the pros and cons of each of these things, but ultimately, what they think is the most important thing about this whole exercise in Brexit is taking back control of various things. So you're not going to see them signing up to things of which there is no control. One key thing to look at is not quite an arbitration panel, but if you have both sides agreeing to high standards, who judges when one side has reduced their standards or is now in conflict with what's being arranged? The EU would like it to be EU institutions that are the arbiter of that, that get to say. But I think the UK will be very uncomfortable with the idea that it is the EU side that get most of a say in that. So I think when we look at the negotiating mandate, which is being decided today, Boris Johnson and senior ministers, but published on Thursday, and we'll also get a statement in the House on Thursday, I think it will be a strident tone because each side is setting up, you know, where they are. But again, it will just be another exercise in how they are currently far apart.
James, do you think that's something the, you don't need to talk about meeting in the middle about arbitration, do you think the UK can live with something like the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, having even a final say on that arbitration panel, or is, do you think there's a middle ground they can, the two sides can meet on here?
So the EU will say that the ECJ must be the ultimate interpreters of EU law. That is why I would suggest that it would not be sensible to have a free trade agreement that required the UK to carry on following EU law, because that would be a skew. I mean, there is obviously an appropriate role to the extent on, so for example, on kind of non-regression, you know, what does that mean? You know, allowing UK courts to be guided by how the ECJ has understood a particular rule or regulation. But I think this really boils down to this question, which is, you know, the UK says, we now want to be treated as sovereign equals of the EU. The EU, not entirely private, basically scoff at this idea. And they have a kind of Melian dialogue approach to this, which is, you know, we are so much bigger than you are in terms of the size of our economies that, you know, we're going to get to set the terms of trade around here. The strong will do as they can and the weak will do as they must. And you are the weak because you've chosen to leave this big bloc, and we live in a world of big blocs. So when you negotiate with us or when you negotiate with the US, you are going to be pushed around. The UK view is, well, we're not going to be. And the interesting question is, you know, which side in this great dispute blinks first? You know, the EU view is that basically, if the UK leaves with a supposed Australian deal, they can make life very difficult at the borders by taking the most hardline approach possible. And, you know, the UK government would struggle to survive an economic hit. The number 10 view is, well, hang on a second, we don't have to face the electorate again until 2024. So if everyone wants to go engage in this kind of path of, you know, mutually assured destruction at the borders, of basically creating tailbacks on either side and economic pain, then, you know, most of you will have to face your voters before we do again, and so you will pay the price at the ballot box for that first.
Moving on to a more cheerful topic, the coronavirus has been spreading throughout Italy, with several towns in the north of the region, north of the country, on complete lockdown with schools closed. And over in the UK, the Health Secretary Matt Hancock has filled everyone with confidence this morning, saying that he was very worried about the disease. Katie, how is the UK government sort of thinking about preparation for coronavirus? Are they worried in government as well, or is this an offhand remark?
Well, I think Matt Hancock is doing better than some in similar briefs to him around the world, given that Iran's deputy health minister has today tested positive for the coronavirus. So Matt Hancock is simply worried rather than currently affected. I do think that we've been talking about the coronavirus now for weeks, both in the magazine and on this podcast, but ultimately, we keep talking about how the fact it could now slide into a point where it becomes uncontrollable, where it gets much worse. So far, the signs haven't been there, but I think it's interesting, the warnings yesterday that actually from the World Health Organization that it could become a pandemic fairly soon. And I do think when you look across some of the reports across the world, so you have the outbreak in Italy, in Iran, it does not seem as though they're managing to control this very well at all, then you begin to see the signs of how it could start to become, I think, something more serious. Now, Matt Hancock's advice to those who have come back from northern Italy is to self-isolate. I think that has also worried some people. But I think there are questions in the sense that if you think it's very likely that these people might have it, then I think the government needs to step in. We know they've got centres in lots of NHS hospitals on coronavirus. I think telling people to self-isolate, what are you saying in terms of their work? Are they supposed to take sick leave for 3 weeks? I think there are a few missing details right now in terms of the practicalities of this. I think the UK government is fairly happy with where they are in terms of preparations should more cases come here. And it's beginning to feel a little bit inevitable that more cases will, just because of how many different countries now that are currently experiencing this. Unless, you know, the country just goes into lockdown and bans flights from everywhere, it just does seem the next step is more cases.
I think the paradox is this. So China and Iran are scary because there are very legitimate reasons to believe that those countries do not tell the truth in their statistics and the information that they present. Just look at how the Iranians claimed that passenger jet had been shot down when it turned out it had actually been shot down by an Iranian missile. The Chinese said today that they were going to hit their economic growth targets despite the coronavirus, which I think ends the debate about whether Chinese economic statistics belong in the fact or fiction section of the library. But then the paradox is, the scary thing about it in Italy and Spain and other liberal democracies is, you know, those liberal democracies struggle to have the powers to constrain the flow of people. You know, people move around so fast and so easily, they aren't tracked or traceable in the way that they are in a more authoritarian society, and so the virus can move around very easily that way. I mean, you know, you see the two dangers there and how they interact. And I think the cases at the moment, what is also concerning is there do seem to be some places where the coronavirus appears to be more potent than it normally is. The Iranian version of it appears to be slightly more potent. Whether it is I think it's far too early to suggest it's a different strain or anything like that. But the transmission there seems, unless the overall numbers are massively wrong, the nature of the transmission there does seem to be different.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And if you're wondering how much you should be worried about the coronavirus hitting the UK shores, then we've got a great piece coming up in the forthcoming issue of The Spectator, where Ross Clark tackles the issue. I hope you don't mind a giveaway, a bit of a spoiler alert. He says we shouldn't be worried too much.